to talk us about what we can do in order to see better images without actually improving hardware. So we observed that modern displays are bigger and brighter, provide more resolution. They have also higher refresh rates. This is due to stereo thing. Yes, we have 120 hertz displays when you actually can feed those displays with 120 frames. And also stereo 3D equipment becomes very popular. We can buy even 3D TV. Still, when we compare capabilities of display devices, that's obvious that they cannot reproduce contrast ranges that we deal in real world. They are not bright enough. This is maybe a little bit less problem. Temporal resolution, you may be surprised. We have 60 hertz and we cannot see flickering. So what's the problem? The problem is that in the real world, we see a continuous information, yes? And in particular, new generation of LCD displays, there are so-called hold tight displays. So they display a frame and they keep it for quite some time. So we have some discretization, and this will have some consequences. I will try to explain what kind of consequences. Spatial resolution. So now Apple promises us retinal displays. So they say that the number of pixels corresponds matches to number of photoreceptors in the fovea. That's true when you look for the display from about 1 meter. When you look from half meter, still you have more photoreceptors projected on a given pixel. So this means that probably we could still distinguish more details that displays can provide to us. And the depth range of 3D displays, anyone who went to movie theater maybe experience some actually drawbacks, sometimes even some problems, although professional make those displays. So the idea of this talk is essentially to look a little bit into properties of human visual system. And display designers, of course, they did it as well. But we will do this in a certain specific way, and we'll try to see whether we could extend those qualities. So add a little bit of contrast brightness, improve apparent temporal resolution. So, of course, I am not talking here about physical properties, so quantities. We will not measure those improvements in physical way using some devices. But actually, when you look into those images, you will have clear impression that they are of better quality. So at first I will just briefly go over all topics that I would like to discuss during this talk, and then I will enter into details. So contrast improvement. So we have this, for HDR people in particular, well known, this full range of luminance that we witness, that we are exposed in the real world. At the same time, we can see maybe up to 5 orders of magnitude, and display, of course, should shrink it even further. So a natural consequence of it is that we have difficulties in reproducing details, maybe in bright regions when we decide to expose better dark part of the scene or vice versa. Or we can do maybe perfect tone mapping, but then still probably you see that this image becomes a little bit flat. You have details both in bright and dark regions, but you lost a little bit this feeling of global contrast. And that's kind of clear when you ask to Kodak people or people who deal with photography. People look even slightly exaggerated contrast. So a little bit more contrast, it would be always good. So I would like to pinpoint your attention to cones with illusion. So the idea here is that the luminance profile that we see is actually follows this blue line here, yes? But what we see is more like step function, yes? So now I will occlude this transition region, and then you see that left and right sides have the same brightness. So this we call cones with illusion. So essentially, something happened on the edge, and feel mechanism in our brain somehow extends this signal from this edge to the whole plane. So that's very good news for us. Yes. So let's imagine this situation. So we have really step function, and we have this circle in the middle created using this profile. So when you look closer, maybe you see a little bit of halo effect. But nevertheless, what we managed to do is reproduce relatively high contrast pattern without using dynamic range in the display. Yes, because at the boundary, we have the same level of luminance as is in the center. So this means dynamic range of display was not lost. and still we reproduce a little bit of contrast. So that will be essentially our trick. We'll add in controlled way cones with illusion to enhance contrast when this contrast was lost. And we can do this without requiring even further increase of dynamic range. And artists, of course, in art, they do this a lot because they deal with media that is even much lower dynamic range than we are. What it will be remarkable, and I come back to this, when they insert coarse with profiles into their painting, they take care that it's aligned with some features, undergoes perspective shortening, things like that. Yes, when you do 2D unsharp masking image processing operations, this is not really the case, and I will show that this may play some role. Concerning brightness, so of course brightness is much lower than in daylight situations. On brightness is also quite complex phenomena that depends on many factors. So let us imagine, let us look at those dots that have the same luminance. Then they're imposed on the same background, so nothing interesting happens. When I impose them on the background of this image on the left, actually you can see that those that are on the bright background will have different brightness, and those that are on the dark background, again, will differ. So we will have like two types of grouping that will depend on background. So clearly what we can say, perception of brightness is relatively complex. Absolute luminance is not so important. Context may be actually important. And within the same, what can be called framework, within the same part of the scene with similar characteristics, all those dots look very similar. So this maybe may suggest that maybe when we do tone mapping and we would like to preserve brightness, we should split scene into framework and consider perceived brightness more or less independently of each of them. And this was actually the topic of one of published tone mapping papers. Here is another illusion concerning brightness. So we put on the table pieces of paper with different reflectance. When we put the first piece of paper with relatively low reflectance, as it is the brightest of the object, we anchored this piece of paper as reference white. Yes, when we put some other pieces of papers with increasing reflectance, they take over as reference white, and this gradually becomes darker and darker. So brightness would be a relative phenomena. What I would like in particular exploit during this talk is adding this kind of smooth profile around bright spots, and this creates glowing effect. Yes, so you have clear impression that this part is much brighter than this hard-edged bright spot, and moreover, we have an impression that light is glowing, that maybe this part emits some light. Of course, there is no emitting light at all. This screen is purely reflective, but impression is quite strong. So we will try to use such effect to improve apparent brightness of our images. And again, I refer to artists do this pretty much. Also in computer games, this effect is exploited pretty much. Next topic that I would like to discuss is temporal resolution. So what you see here, there are some two bars that are refreshed with different frequency. And I don't have hardware acceleration, so this video was maybe not so smooth. But probably you could see that the bar that moves, that is refreshed with 30 hertz, looks a little bit more blurred than the one that is refreshed with 60 hertz. And of course, when video stops, then of course you see that they are the same bars. So on the display, everything is perfectly the same. The thing happens in our brain, how we perceive those two things. And I will explain why this happens in a minute. One more experiment. So. Please try to look at the center of this blue line for a while, and then probably what you should see, you will see relatively sharp image. And now please follow the motion. So please try to see one column and look how it moves. And probably you will see this column quite blurred. So again, image is just the same. The other thing is processing in our brain that distorts this impression of sharpness. So why this happens? I will briefly explain, and I will come back in more details a little bit later. In reality, when we have continuous motion, And when something is moving, where we are interested, we immediately follow. We use so-called smooth pursuit eye motion to track this object because we want to keep it in fovea region and we want to see it sharp. So for continuous motion, we have continuous smooth pursuit eye motion and everything is fine. When we have hold type display, in particular LCD display, smooth pursuit eye motion goes, but image is frozen, is hold on the screen for quite some time, yes? And then we switch to frame number two. So we deal with continuous eye tracking of interesting part, while images are discrete, they are displayed one after another. So the result is, of course, blur. So we'll try to discuss some algorithm how to combat this blur. I will not discuss another phenomena that is related. It's called judder. And this phenomena we witness when, for example, some old movie that was recorded with 20 frames per second is converted into, say, 60 hertz. Then clearly you have some situations that some frames are duplicated three times, and then certain frames will be duplicated only two times. And again, if something is scrolling on the screen, again, when we have this smooth motion of some pattern on the image, you will see these discontinuities, yes? Like smooth, 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 slightly different speed, and again, this effect is called judder. And that's, again, the problem, and problem related with temporal aspect of displaying images and this hold type effect. Another issue, spatial resolution. So here there are some images of photoreceptors of cones in the fovea done in proper scale, and then we projected size of pixel of high definition full HD display observed from 50 centimeter distance. And what you clearly can see, this was taken for different people, so density of photoreceptors may slightly differ, but we have still many photoreceptors that probably, when we provide higher resolution signal, can resolve for us more details. So there is this acuity problem. There is also another issue that I will not discuss, so-called hyperacuity, so more localization problem. And then when we have some elongated patterns, so vernier acuity pattern, so-called, we are able to distinguish dislocation of those bars by maybe some fraction of the size of cone. So that's not resolution issue, that's localization issue, that we are able to localize them. And I will not discuss this issue here, but I want that you are aware of such effects. So display resolution, photoreceptor resolution is high. Also, we are able those days to produce, I will show it again, high density photographs. Yes, so cameras with 40 megapixels is nothing unusual. We can create panoramas. We have gigapixel photography. When we do computer graphics, our capabilities in the rendering details are almost unlimited. So again, kind of clear resolution bottleneck would be display. Yes, so we have high resolution images, high resolution receptor display has not enough resolution. And the question is whether we can do something to improve this situation. And final topic that I will touch today would be stereo 3D. So we have different technologies for separating views for left and right eye. We have a lot of content. Computer games use quite often 3D technology those days. We have TV sets in home. So of course, depth perception is again quite complex phenomena, depends on many cues. I will be interested today on stereoscopic depth cues due to binocular disparity. But I will mention also other depth cues related with accommodation of the eye, that we focus at certain depths, and related divergence of left and eye, right eye, to this particular distance. And there are also pictorial cues, and when we do graphics, we don't have problems with those pictorial cues, because when we do realistic image synthesis, we can reproduce them quite well on flat displays. But of course, reproducing those 3D cues required 3D space. Yes, we need some space to verge our eyes on maybe in front or in the last row in this room. So this we need to cheat a little bit human visual system, pretend that it can see what actually is difficult to be seen. And we do this, that's a very basic slide. Yes, we have screen, we have image rendered for right eye. It is separated from the image from the left eye. There is some dislocation, which we'll call pixel disparity. between corresponding patterns for displayed for the left and right eye, and then we can fuse those two images, and then actually we will see this object in this particular point. And again, we should remember that we look at the screen, yes? So our accommodation is adjusted to the distance of the screen, while vergence and actually placement of the object does not correspond to display position. So clearly, we may face, in certain situations, viewing discomfort, in particular when we lead to such situation that this fusion will be beyond this comfort zone, which is really in proximity of display screen. So essentially, what people do those days, they manipulate disparity in order to squeeze depth into this zone of comfort. And what I will try to show is how to achieve some certain level of comfort, but at the same time preserve possibly wide impression of depth. So essentially, as I said, I will focus on stereo depth cues, and I will discuss certain model that will predict how much depth we actually see, and we'll use this model to do disparity manipulation in controlled way. So that was an overview of my talk. You roughly know the scope and all those display qualities that I would like to address. And now I will go a little bit deeper into algorithmic level that we know on technical side how those things are organized. So let me start from coarse width illusion. And here I will assume that we have a high quality, high dynamic range image where all contrast is properly captured. And then we have tone map image, yes, so compressed image. And of course, contrast is missing. So tone map image, tone mapping is about compression of contrast, yes. So we could do naive kind of enhancement of contrast, but then we can change also impression of the image if we do this by random. We sharpen the whole image, for example, yes. And on the other hand, we expect that when we use state-of-the-art tone mapping operators, not much can be done. Those tone mapping operators allocate contrast to available dynamic range quite well. So we will refer rather to spatial dimensions. So we will introduce certain profiles, coarse width profiles, that will affect a number of pixels on the left and right side of a given edge. So now the question is how much of this correction we need to introduce. So we will measure lost contrast, and we'll do this at a number of bands. So we will decompose our image, high dynamic range image, into a number of bands. And for each of those bands, we will compare how much contrast has been lost, and we'll try to restore this contrast. This way, we hope to maintain appearance of the image and also communicate loss of image content. So this information that was potentially lost due to tone mapping will be hopefully restored. And I mentioned so far about coarse width profile like this, symmetric on both sides, but our repertoire to and pump up contrast will be much wider. So we can introduce another type of profile with this discontinuity on one side. It will be slightly less effective, but still this will be valid approach. Also, what would be very interesting for us is that we can cascade coarse width effects. So essentially, we can impose one profile next to another. And then, essentially, what we'll see that this part will be significantly darker than part of the bright side because we use this coarse width effect maybe three times. So we'll somehow integrate signal over edges and we'll make this impression that this right part from this integration should be much brighter. So we should choose profile to our situation in the image. Of course, amplitude of the profile should be, in some sense, proportional to loss contrast. I will talk a little bit more about this. When we have some texture noise, this will not destroy the illusion. Illusion will be still there when we introduce it on both sides of textured elements. And profiles, we should not exaggerate with this effect because then we can create halo effect. So when we look, for example, for high dynamic range reference image, and this is what happens due to tone mapping, so contrast is lost, we would like to restore it. So technically, we'll do low pass filtering. We subtract from original image low pass filtered image. Then we have high frequencies, of course. we add high frequencies, and then at top of this signal we have cone sweet profile, and visually something similar to the reference is kind of restored. So this is nothing else as unsharp masking. Unsharp masking works that well. But we may have the following problem, that maybe tone mapping was pretty good in reproducing high frequency details, yes? So now when we use this typical unsharp masking scheme, again, low pass filter, so high frequency signal will contain both cone sweet profile, but also fully this high frequency information. So this information is not lost in our tone map image. So we add it twice, yes? So we exaggerate with details. So naive doing unsharp masking will not work. So what we need to do, essentially, we need to decompose high dynamic range image and low dynamic range image into frequency bands. So we will use first at first Gaussian, and then we will, based on Gaussian, we will calculate contrast. So for each band, we'll have contrast at given pixel. We subtract the value from lower frequency band and we normalize it. So we'll have some contrast measure in each band. And then we will calculate ratio of contrast in a reference image and in tone map image. Yes? So this ratio will tell us if it is one, this means contrast is fully reproduced. If it is fraction, then contrast is lost. If this is more than one, less likely contrast is magnified. So now we have some guidance. We know per band how much contrast have been lost. And then we can try to, whenever it's possible, to restore this contrast. So what is good about such restoration is that lost contrast, or essentially this ratio defines how much of what should be amplitude of cone sweet profile, so how much cone sweet profile we should restore. Also, when it happens that we lost some contrast on lower frequency, this means also when we do the decomposition in the Fourier domain of a step function, it will contain also all higher frequencies. So this means that we should, when a signal is lost at certain band, we should consider also all higher frequency bands in order to reproduce both cone sweet profile and in order to restore this contrast. And finally, spatial extent of this profile will be decided based on frequency for which we notice loss of contrast. So this cone sweet effect is not kind of one-to-one effect, that we add cone sweet effect of certain amplitude and we recovered that much contrast. This effect will have illusion will have some limitations. So this graph shows this. Yes, so we have edge contrast, so contrast of cone sweet profile, and here we have perceived perceived contrast. So this is actually what we are going to see. So we notice that ideally we would like to have one-to-one mapping, yes, but we get close to this mapping for cone sweet profile of very wide extent. Because you can imagine when you continue this extension to infinity, this is just step function, so this is not a surprise. When you make this profile narrower and narrower, then this gain is a little bit weaker. So we should have this in mind. So here are some examples of application of this idea. So at the top we have global tone mapping, which lost many details in tone map image, and then we detected this, and then counter shading profiles restores those high frequency details back. On the other hand, at the bottom, we use contrast equalization, so kind of gradient domain tone mapping operator, which is pretty good in reproducing details, but then the global impression of contrast is lost. And then profiles that have been introduced are of lower spatial frequency. Here is another example. So here is our tone map image. Here is a high dynamic range reference, which of course cannot be reproduced on this display. But what is kind of clear that this image is a little bit flat. We lost distinction between foreground and skyline. So this situation again got detected. We introduced this kind of cone sweet profile, and this way we got separation of foreground and background. And again, pixels at the top and the bottom of image have not been changed because this. Only those pixels affected here have been enhanced. So you can imagine many counter shading variants. So far I discuss only luminance signal, and we added contrast also in luminance domain. But you can imagine also such situation that your signal is completely different. For example, depth. And as a function of depth, you add some contrast to the image. You could also add coarsened profiles to chromatic signal. Finally, what I would like to show briefly, when we have color to gray problem, we have dimensionality reduction. Yes, so we can again kind of enhance contrast in such situation. So here is an example from work of Luft, when he considered depth maps, and based of difference of depth, he introduced coarsened profiles, and strength of those coarsened profiles corresponds to depth differences. Here is another example when coarsened profile was added to chroma signal, and again, probably the impression of contrast was overall improved. So here is this color to gray problem, and in this particular example, we have isoluminant patterns. So luminance of those patterns is the same. So if we calculate luminance using this Thiele standard equation, this image will be flat because there is no difference in luminance. So what one can do is we can still see that here we have isoluminant colors, and still some of them will perceive a little bit brighter, like blue. So we can take this into account, and this would be equivalent to using so-called Helmholtz Kollerausch effect. But this may be not enough, because this is kind of per pixel thing. Yes, you essentially check what is color of this pixel, and you add to luminance appropriate amount of correction. But this effect doesn't take into account contrast in a chroma signal. Yes, so here we have some contrast, and this contrast comes fully from color signal. So what we can try to do is we can analyze this lost contrast that originally was in chromatic signal, that when we derive our color to gray image, so gray image, this contrast was lost, and we can restore this contrast again using coarsened profile. So here we have like color image simple conversion using GIMP software. Here is conversion using this Helmholtz Kollerausch effect, and additionally enhanced using this coarsened effect. And the last example, again, Helmholtz Kollerausch effect, and then enhancement due to coarsened profiles. So again, I will repeat, we detect contrast in chromatic part, and we add this contrast in chromatic part in luminance signal to enhance this image. So counter shading in 3D. So here we have like 3D image, and again, the same trick. But I believe effect will be even stronger than when I do this on flat patches that I showed so far. So Purs and Lotto, in their paper, they claim that if we align coarsened profile, we embed it into the scene, and it follows perspective shortening and so on, this effect will be even stronger. So one can do this in a relatively easy way in graphics. Yes, mesh-based shading, we low pass. We use low-pass filtering over mesh, so kind of Laplacian. Then we get high-frequency signal by subtracting from original image this low-pass image. This is high-frequency signal. We added a top original image, and then we have 3D unsharp masking. And here is traditional 2D unsharp masking, so purely image processing-based operation. So what would be the difference? The difference would be that when we do this in 3D object space, naturally we embed coarsened profiles along perspective shortening. This is somehow automatically done for free. And that's important, as Purs and Lotto claims. Also, our shading will be somehow glued to the surface. So when we rotate, when we move, for traditional 3D unsharp masking, 2D unsharp masking, you will see some effects on the boundary. This is in this case, more natural. And again, when we have some occluded surfaces, coarsened profile will be independently for the ground and independently for those bones in front. So essentially, at the intersection points, this will look more aligned and more natural. So those are kind of subtle cues, but this is what decides about stronger effect of coarsened illusion when we do this in 3D. So some examples, because it is object space operation, then we can get, we are not worrying about pixel accuracy when we do this in 2D. And here is my favorite example in this case. So the task was to reproduce shadow, which should be relatively deep because we have high contrast between bright and dark regions. But on the other hand, we expect that in the real world, we would be able to see text in the shadow region. So by introducing constraint profile on this boundary, we reproduce high contrast at the edge, at still inside, this level is relatively bright, so we can still have some contrast left to reproduce text. And the recent work of Rafał Mantyuk at Eurographics and his co-authors shows that we have kind of three instances of this constraint effect. So we can use it for improving sharpness by adding very kind of tiny profiles. When those profiles will be slightly more extended in space, something that I discussed mostly during this talk, then we can enhance contrast. And when we exaggerate, of course, we have halo effect, and we don't want such situation. So let us switch now to brightness illusion, to enhancement of brightness. So I come back to this glare illusion, and I will try to show our way of pumping up image brightness. So here's an example from game scenario. So you can compare brightness of this dot and this sun. Probably sun looks brighter. Of course, pixel-wise, that's the same saturated, fully white pixels. So introducing of this smooth profile, of this fuzzy profile is important. Why this happens? Yes, this is maybe not very rigorous explanation, but one may expect that when high intensity light comes to our eye, our optics is not perfect, and this point spread function will be relatively wide. So neighboring regions will be polluted by parasite lighting, so this will result in reducing contrast around. Yes, on the display, we cannot reproduce such bright pixels, so this effect cannot be triggered by display, but we can cheat a little bit and directly render on the retina something that's supposed to be reproduced by our poor optic. And this way, brain would interpret that it must be something bright because it created the same pattern as in a real-world situation. So in games, of course, people use such effects, and very often they use simply Gaussian or kind of pyramid of Gaussians to get even smoother distribution of this profile. What I would like to focus today is more or less physical simulation, taking into account how eye is built and how diffraction of light happens inside our eye. And my motivation is that I would like to add this glare pattern and possibly even consider some dynamic aspects, because when we observe bright small light sources in particular, the condition of our eye would be not fully stable. So what I mean by this instability? So first of all, we will consider pupil. And then when we look into bright spot, the pupil will shrink. And then when we lose part of this bright spot, pupil will increase a little bit radius. So we'll get some, like, in control theory situation when essentially we'll get this motion is called hippus. So some motion shrinking size of pupil in an unstable way. And the only consequence of this would be that image will be brighter or darker. So another effect that we would like to consider is we have some impurities in lens. And those lens goes this motion due to accommodation. So essentially it's kind of elastic substance. So those impurities will follow the motion of lens. And due to impurities, we'll have this ciliary corona effect. So when you look into bright spot and you see this effect, this is caused by those impurities. Also, at the periphery of lens, we'll have more pronounced fiber structure, which will act as diffraction net. So we consider also this, and because of this diffraction net of periphery, you start to have this lenticular halo effect. We can add even more complexity. So again, we have some impurities in vitreous humor, and they move with slight different dynamic. So you could also simulate this. And when you squint eyes, eyelashes, this is more like a joke than simulation, you can have additional diffractional effect. So what we do in practice, we simulate these those effects for wavelength. And what is nice is that you could just rescale pattern obtained for this simulation for different wavelengths, and then you get like full color pattern. So computationally, it is very simple, more simple than one could expect. So essentially, we assume single plane aperture. So we assume that all obstacles in the eye, so both pupil impurities in the lens, eyelashes, and so on, everything lies is located in one plane. This is why we call single aperture plane model. So we just render high resolution image, and this image can be dynamic. Those parties can move, whatever. But this is single image, single plane. And then we do Fourier transform of this image. And when our model is Fraunhofer, which is not listed here, like a little bit simple diffraction model, then immediately just Fourier transform of this single aperture plane model gives us point spread function. So then we take this point spread function, convolve our image, and we are done. Yes? Here, in this example, we use Fresnel diffraction model, which takes into account, in some sense, real curvature of eye, some path in the eye. This is why we have this imaginary part. So essentially, what we need to do once more, we generate one plane image with all occluders on the way of light to the retina. We multiply it with this imaginary part. And then we calculate just Fourier transform. Then we have simulation for one wavelength. Then we duplicate the outcome of this resolution for simulation for many wavelengths. And then we have point spread function. And from this point of view, we just convolve this point spread function with image content. So again, we will do this in Fourier domain. This is why we take our original image, and we take this point spread function. We calculate once for Fourier transform. Then we perform filtering in Fourier domain. This is just multiplication. We do inverse Fourier transform, and we have our image. So computationally, if you buy this single aperture approximation, this would be a relatively simple trick. So now what would be difference of such real simulation versus what people usually do? So people usually will generate offline this point spread function, and we place it at brightest pixels. So we could call this approach kind of billboard approach. On the other hand, more correct approach would be to convolve so all bright pixels in the image with this point spread function, and then we can get such effect. So again, I will show a dynamic case. So here is real convolution, here is kind of billboard approach, and you can see that because of elongated shape of flame in this direction, in perpendicular directions, those ciliary corona effects a little bit cancels out, is less pronounced, and you can see those tracks only a long flame direction. So this is what we would probably see. Here is another example. And that was this part that concerned improving brightness. So by adding, again, some profiles, we can cheat a little bit and project on the retina pattern that is expected that it comes from bright light sources. So I come to the temporal resolution issue, whole type blur effect. So I show you those two simple experiments. I don't know whether they were convincing or not, but I will recall once more that idea here is that in real world, we have this smooth pursuit motion that tracks smoothly moving object. For display, this image of this object is held for certain time, while our retinal motion or our photoreceptors are projected are moving relatively across to the images. So this causes effect of blur. So maybe initially we thought, people thought that we have this blur of the motion due to slow response of display. This was really the case maybe a couple of years ago when the response time of LCD sandwich was maybe 60 milliseconds or something like this. Today the response is 2 milliseconds, yes? Moreover, we have some procedures for overdriving, yes? So if we want to go from one level in LCD to another level, electronics will add some signal that will do some overdrive. So we will even move faster. So this is those days not the reason of blur. The reason of blur is purely perceptual. The reason of blur is smooth pursuit eye motion, so this tracking ability. And this effect can be relatively simply modeled as a box function in temporal domain. So this effect comes naturally, yes? I mean, I didn't need to encourage you when those bars were moving on the screen that you should follow them, yes? I didn't give you any instruction, yes? And you just followed them, and this just naturally happens. Something is moving, you are interested in something that moves, you would like to keep it in the center of fovea when you have highest resolution of photoreceptors, and we are very good at such things. So at velocities, angular velocities is maybe up to 7 degrees per second, so relatively quick motion. Yes, so you can imagine one visual degree maybe for my desktop would be something like 4 pixels. So if I move 7 multiplied by 40 pixels, 280 pixels per second, that's really fast motion. And still we are able to track this object quite well, keep it in the center of our fovea. Also, when we have mixed context, many objects are moving. When we lose interest in one object, we switch through saccade, we move to another object, and again we track it. And this happens very quickly, yes, this switching of context. Yes, otherwise we would not survive if we have a number of predators who attack us. Yes, we should be very quick. So one may ask about some other motion of the eye that that we know that they exist, like tremor drifts, microsaccades, things like that. But they happen both in static conditions and dynamic conditions, and brain somehow compensates for them. So the clear issue is how to compensate for this, or what to do to overcome this problem of this inherent tracking, how to overcome this problem of this smooth pursuit eye motion. So how, in the first place, people in TV industry address this problem? Yeah, so this problem didn't exist when we have CRT displays, because CRT displays were kind of, you remember that there was this scanning line, so we have like very short impulses in the screen. So that was definitely not hold type display, that this image is sustained and displayed for a certain amount of time. Yes, it was just blinking, this image. Of course, it had some disadvantages because we could never get with high enough level of brightness, things like that. Nevertheless, we didn't have this blurring effect. So people thought, okay, instead of in LCD display, instead of full time allocated for frame displaying our image, we can use maybe only blink this image. Of course, you will pay some price in terms of darkening. Yes. Even easier, you can do this impulse kind of thing by flashing backlight. Yes, so probably initially that was at least my thought, that when I have on my desktop LCD display, it will be very stable image. Yes, but actually, to combat this smooth pursuit eye motion, modern TV there are like deciphered, described as 500 hertz or something like this, and they use quite actively this backlight flashing. So they, if you would take high speed camera, you would see those effects. So this slide illustrates what I discussed so far. Yes, so here we have like horizontal x-axis on the display, and here we have time domain. Yes, and when we have hold type display, the same pattern is displayed for a certain amount of time. One, why our eye scan the display due to smooth pursuit eye motion. Yes, on the other hand, when you have impulsive display, CRT like, this image is displayed for a short moment of time and then it's black. So we scan the screen, but nothing happens. We don't accumulate this information that may contribute to blur. Modern TV sets, they doubling or quadrupling or whatever, yes, frame rate. So essentially, they take 50 hertz frames, and then they will calculate some optical flow, and they will extrapolate. In fact, they will interpolate some in-between frames. So they will introduce some delay to the signal, but that's not a big problem. Yes, you get some signal, TV signal. They will not display it immediately, but they will collect two keyframes, and then they will calculate in between frames using kind of image-based rendering approach, and then they will display when those frames are ready. In the context of gaming, that's actually not the best solution. Yes, this delay, because gamers would notice this kind of latency. So what essentially it does, for example, 120 hertz frame rate instead of 60, is that they take original frame, they will, through optical flow, interpolate in between frames, and they will be properly moving, yes, because optical flow, motion flow will be taken into account. And this way, we will get smoother motion. So this is a snapshot taken from one commercial TV and using high speed camera, and what you can clearly see that when it gets original frame, it's kind of high quality, and then those in-between frames are slightly lower quality. But everything happens at 200 hertz, and actually we don't see it, and blur is reduced. Yes, because while we have this smooth pursuit eye motion, even if the image is crappy, more kind of blur could be caused when it would be still than crappy and moving. So what would be our solution in this situation? So we assume that we render frames at 40 Hertz, and then, okay, that's pretty traditional thing. We could use image-based rendering, essentially warp our frames and get two additional in-between frames. Yeah? So we have 120 Hertz out of 40 Hertz rendering. But when we do this in traditional way, those people who have some experience in image-based kind of rendering, you know that even if you have depths, which in rendering is easy to get, still you may have some artifacts. So occlusion, disocclusion artifact, but also this image will be not perfect. So then surprise, what we are going to do, we are going to blur those in between frames. So please notice that our goal is to get sharpened appearance, yes? And now what we are going to do, those frames that are poor quality, we are going to blur. So this, of course, is not perfect solution. We should somehow compensate for this blurred information. So what we are going to do, we are actually sharpen those frames that are originally computed. So they're originally computed, they don't have artifacts, so they can relatively artifact-free can be sharpened. And we add that amount of sharpening to compensate blurring for those in-between frames. And because we display the whole thing at 120 Hertz, our eye will integrate signal and will not see much difference. So what happens in this situation is that high-frequency signal is displayed only, it blinks, it displayed only for this frame. So we have kind of impulse treatment of high-frequency signal. Low-frequency signal is displayed every frame, but low-frequency signal, who cares? I mean, this is those frequencies are below what is filtered out due to smooth pulse width eye motion, yes? So we got this impulsive thing for high-frequency, for low-frequency, it is not important. So again, this has something to do with adding this ConSuite kind of profile. So we have original frame, we have those two derived in-between frames, we blur them, yes? So we remove high frequencies. So this is signal that has been lost. So this signal we need somehow reconstruct here. And we don't care about previous frames, we just take this frame and just sharpen it. Of course, you may ask what will happen when we are close to very bright and very dark pixels. Of course, we cannot execute these symmetric two-side profiles. But we learn that even one-side profile will do work, yes? So it will be slightly less effective, but still will do work. So technically, we do such warping. This is nothing very special. Based on the mesh, in the simplest inclination, this mesh can be static. This doesn't give the best results. So we calculate essentially according to motion flow how vertices of mesh are warped in the next frame and when distort image accordingly. Yes? So one can do even better by aligning those points to major features in geometry. This gives a much better result. And I don't have a video for this, but in a kind of latest incarnation, we do also adaptive splitting of mesh. So for some high contrast features in depth, we will split mesh elements into smaller elements. So here we can compare the quality with snapping, so aligning with major features in depth and without snapping. And essentially we get very similar quality using this approach to original frames. So we ask in experiments, we run a 40 Hertz animation, like kind of walkthrough animation, and we have static image, and we ask people using the knob to add to this static image as much blur as they see for this image refresh with 40 Hertz versus refresh with 120 Hertz. And you can see that this 40 Hertz refresh rate, people see image pretty much blurred, which they mark that way, and we know why this really happens. So again, when we take high frequency snapshot of display, you see that we introduce some blinking, yes? So this blinking comes from high frequencies. But because everything happens at 120 Hertz, this is not really well visible. So we ran some experiment to compare for various animations how this solution with duplicating and blurring frames, so our solution compares to native 120 Hertz, and usually it compares quite well, while 40 Hz, of course, is perceived as much lower quality. The only exception is Camel. And Camel is kind of galloping image, but Camel stands in one place. Yes, and then there is no this effect of smooth pulse with eye motion. This motion of leg is very difficult to track. It is very chaotic. And then because there is no this smooth pulse with effect, there is less blur and the difference will be less pronounced. We develop also simple game and we ask people to, like in this Landhold test, mark when they see this torus with such break versus continuous torus. So we measured effectiveness for different scenarios of refresh rate. And again, like native 120 Hz and our approach, performance in game was kind of comparable and it clearly drops when the refresh rate goes lower. So at this point, I would like to make a very short stop. So I think this rendering at 120 Hz or maybe we'll have a display with higher refresh rate will be very inspiring in coming years. Yes, people definitely will render some frames that are maybe not perfect quality or they will render different aspect of the scene for different frames and they were hoping that through integration we will just get an impression what we want. Yes, so this is what happened here. Yes, I rendered the high quality image and I sharpened them and then I inserted to blurred image. Everything was integrated and it was fine. But I think there is more room for different kind of manipulation of images. In particular, the idea would be to render something of lower quality and when it is combined, you see it as perfect quality. Another important thing is that when we have traditional displays, say 50 or 60 Hz, very often we report in graphics that our GPU algorithm can render something with 400 Hz. Yes, and this is actually completely lost, yes, because display will pick up only some selected frames and will display it because display can be fed with 50 Hz or 60 Hz input signal. Yes, traditional display. So those frames are essentially lost. So when we use kind of a display that can accept 120 Hz as, as input, then of course it will take more frames. And we will, my question is, why a poor TV set should reconstruct motion flow without any knowledge and reconstruct these poor quality images, while we sometimes can provide those images directly and then we'll get much better quality. Another issue that I would like to discuss is spatial resolution. So I already mentioned that we don't have usually problem with high resolution input material. It's generated by graphics captured using cameras. Also, we have more photoreceptors that actually are kind of stimulated by typical pixels. So display is bottleneck. So how we can make, again, an impression that we can see more details that display can reproduce. So here is kind of outline of our solution. So we have high resolution image and we will decompose it into low resolution frames. Those frames are of resolution of display, yes? And then we introduce some motion. Again, smooth pulse with eye motion would be kind of related with this. And our idea is that due to such combination, we should think or we should get an effect that we see image of slightly higher resolution. So in the first place, why we need this motion? This would be kind of a drawback of our approach. We need to introduce some motion, yes, in order to get this apparent resolution enhancement. So let us imagine that image is static and those circles are projection of photoreceptor on a given pixel, yes? So let us consider what kind of signal will be integrated over photoreceptors A, B, and C. And signal over pixel 1 and 2 will be changing as a function of time. So we have first frame, A and B integrate the same signal, yes? We change content, we go to next frame, A and B, of course, expose all the time the same signal. So not surprise, for static image, A and B will accumulate at the end the same signal. They were projected on the same pixel, so there is no difference. So now let us try to understand the following situation. Yes, that image is moving, and when something is moving, we know already that we have smooth pulse with eye motion. We follow this pattern. So this means that photoreceptors will be crossing image plane while pixels will be changing. So let us consider again photoreceptors ABC. So first frame all integrated this blue signal. Then they are continuously moving, yes? And we change color of pixels, next frame. A and B integrate still the same signal. Photoreceptors C integrate already different signals. So I am making those stops, but you should imagine that photoreceptors move smoothly, yes? And then we have frame number three, and then we can see that the outcome of integration in temporal domain is different for every photoreceptor. So that's the idea, yeah, that possibly to provide to each photoreceptor slightly different signal. And if the signal will be correct, we will reproduce impression of high-resolution image. So let us analyze path of single photoreceptor across image plane. So we have this smooth pulse with eye motion. Yes, we come to this point. Now frame changes, different colors. Photoreceptors move farther. We reach some boundary. So we move only over such short segment. Now photoreceptors enter to another pixel. Again, integrates color. And you can imagine if this goes on and farther. So then the final photoreceptor signal is just integration over the whole path, taking into account length of segments and color of pixels that have been displayed at given moment of time, yes? So this equation tells us that intensity of pixels that have been crossed by these photoreceptors also change as a function of time, and those weights wi corresponds to the length of segments, yes? So now if we assume, and this is a simplistic assumption, if you compare what we have seen at the beginning at the photograph of the retina, that photoreceptors will be spaced in a grid pattern, and that they will move with continuous velocity and just pixels will be changing. This is our assumption. We may come with the following model. So here, this column corresponds to expanded into column images. Let's assume that we have like three images. Those weights will correspond to paths to those segments, yes? That given photoreceptor, so each row in this equation corresponds to one photoreceptor, yes? And those weights would be those weights over the pixels that this photoreceptor crossed. And here we will have intensity of pixels for at three different moments of time. And at the end, we'll get some signal integrated over photoreceptor, and the equation will be exactly as we introduced. So that's mathematical formulation of the whole thing. But what we actually know and what we don't know. So we know high-resolution image, and we know also those weights due to integrated path. And what we want to derive, we would like to derive optimal images that will be displayed one after another in order to trigger impression of this high-resolution image. So this forms like constraint optimization problem, constrained because those intensity of pixels should be in the level from 0 to 255, yes? We cannot get negative pixels or pixels over 255. So essentially, we solve this system, and then we know what kind of images we should display one after another. So those images come from optimization. They look a little bit like scrambled. What is remarkable that they definitely contain a lot of high frequencies, yes? Because we want to feed human visual system with high frequencies. So we should have them somewhere. So they are here. And they are so optimization through so skillfully selected, that when they integrate, they will create an impression of a kind of readable text. So we went with one of experiments to kind of extreme. We use kind of 2x3 pixel masks to encode full alphabet, yes? So just 6 pixels. And because we have this horizontal motion in this case, all aspects of characters that are important in horizontal direction will be enhanced because, in fact, I'm saying that I use 2x3 mask, but I will repeat this mask slightly different signal maybe for 3 different frames. So in some sense, I have here 6 pixels, and when I have 3 different instances in time, maybe I have 18 pixels that somehow may contribute to the scene pattern. And actually, even for such mask, all those characters that are underlined, one can read mostly without errors. Some characters are more difficult, and I should say maybe at this point, if it is not clear, that this enhancement of resolution I have only in direction of motion, yes? In direction perpendicular to the motion, there is no reason that resolution is enhanced, yes? But you can use motion across diagonal and then you have a little bit enhancement in horizontal and vertical direction. So effect is really kind of clear. It requires, again, 120 Hz display, and I will explain in a minute why. It is so clear when we ask people again to rank quality of images that contain high frequency content, people without any doubt could show our method as much better. Although we compare it in this case with Lanczos filtering, and we have this high resolution image, and for each instant of position of the frame, we did this Lanczos filtering and downsampling again. So we use, of course, the best scenarios. This was not like naive downsampling high resolution image and shifting it. Yes, each time for each position we downsampled and provided the best optimal image, and still our approach was better. So we extended this approach also for videos, and then of course it works. We analyze where we have some motion, and when something is moving, we hope it will trigger your attention. You will have this smooth pursuit eye motion, and we will do this temporal enhancement for those moving parts. At this year's SIGGRAPH, there will be presented not by us, but Fatal and his collaborator work when they slightly change convention. So we force our images to move, and what they do, they introduce circular motion of display, and they get a similar effect of resolution enhancement. So motion component should be there because we would like for our photoreceptors to provide slightly different signals so that each photoreceptor has unique signal. And optimization will tell how to calculate those images that this signal will be provided. So question may arise of flickering. Yes, so I showed that I have this decomposition of this text into three high-frequency scrambled little bit text. So one may expect that he would see a little bit flickering, yes? And in particular, that our kind of common knowledge is that this critical flicker frequency would be around, say, 60 Hz, maybe for some people even slightly higher. But this is only true for patterns that have relatively wide spatial extent. This is why when you have like LCD display and when it is bright, because you have another law that tells us that flickering will increase will be proportional to the log of luminance. So the brighter is the image, the more flickering probably you can expect. And now if you have like transition from white to black, yes, on over wide area of the display, then we have this situation. Yes, so the spatial extent of our pattern is relatively wide, and then this critical frequency will be around 60 Hz. When we talk about small patterns, so we introduce these pixel level patterns. So like angular space of those patterns will be relatively narrow, and then we will be characterized by this red curve, and then this critical frequency will be around 40 Hz. So this means if we have 120 Hz display, we can freely kind of switch in time three frames, and then we have like 40 Hz effectively, and still we will not see flickering. So given that maybe future technology would let even higher kind of refresh rate of displays, then probably we can optimize for more frames, and we may expect more gain. So gain will be limited again by resolution of photoreceptor, because it will be bottom line. If we address every photoreceptor with really different signal, then not much can be done further. And the last part of my talk will be related with stereoscopic depth skews, with binocular disparity. And I would like to sketch derivation of model, how we perceive depth. I mean, but coming only from this one cue. So don't be confused that we solve all kind of problems. So in complex images, you have more cues, and we actually will not consider interaction of those cues, which is a huge mistake. Nevertheless, we will try to predict how you see depth just based on pixel disparity. So again, we come back to pixel disparity. So when pattern coincides with image plane, then we have no dislocation between left and right eye motion, so we have zero disparity. When we move farther from image plane, then of course we'll have a bigger disparity. So those disparities I will call pixel disparity, yes? So something in graphics we call for short disparity. For people in perception, they will be confused. So I will call this kind of disparity pixel disparity because it's image space and tells us by how many pixels certain patterns are dislocated. So what I would like to achieve is that I would like to take stereo image pair and then get pixel disparity map. When we do computer graphics, that will be easy. When we have two cameras for left and right eye motion, this will be more problematic. People do it. Again, they will calculate like flow between pixels. This flow can be maybe aligned with horizontal line. Problem is not so difficult, and sometimes they also use some sift features essentially to get certain key points when you have like perfect registration. Yes? So they will assume that sift features will be perfectly registered, and this will improve accuracy of this optical flow kind of computation. So this is possible. You can derive a disparity map even if you have two images. In computer graphics, it's very easy to derive it directly. And then we'll modify pixel disparity, and then we use image-based rendering. So again, kind of mesh, kind of deformation that according to new disparity field will generate left and right eye image. So the key thing is that I would like to consider, we have some pixel disparity, we will modify this pixel disparity, and I would like to know how much I modified it. What impact this will have on perception. So, depth difference. The question is, we have two objects, and the question is whether we can distinguish difference in depth. Yes? If we cannot distinguish difference in depth, then maybe we don't need to encode it so hardly, or we would like to know when actually, what would be our sensitivity for depth differences. So, we would like to know, we would like to measure in some perceptually aligned scale, how big is magnitude of depth that we perceive. So let us start for a simple task. We assume that objects are located at the same depth, and then we change depth of one of those objects, and then we would like to find some boundary when we start notice that they may have different depths. So this depth difference would be just noticeable. So this is kind of, in perception, a well-known term, just noticeable difference. So we will assign unit, one GND, one just noticeable difference to the point when we start with certain probability, maybe 75% probability, people start distinguishing that those two objects are at different depths. So we can measure it, yes? And it turns out that when we consider sinusoidal pattern of different spatial frequency, our sensitivity to depth will be quite different. So experiment is like this, that we show some sinusoid, and then essentially we start from flat plane, and then we increase amplitude of sinusoid, and we want to capture the moment when people start to see that there is some sinusoid here. And here we have spatial frequency. So I don't know whether you are familiar with contrast sensitivity function for luminance. So kind of for certain spatial frequency, we are more sensitive. We are not so sensitive for low frequencies and for high frequencies. Between, say, four to 10 cycles per visual degree, we will be the most sensitive for luminance. So for disparity, we have the same situation, yes? Only scale is slightly different. So please notice that for luminance, maybe like cutoff frequency will be something, I don't know, 50, 60 hertz. And here, cutoff frequency for depth will be around 5, 7, maybe maximum 10 cycles per visual degree. So we are the range of of frequencies that we are sensitive for depth changes will be much lower, yes? And the maximum sensitivity will be maybe for 0.3 cycles per visual degree. And here we have disparity, yes? So this minimum disparity that we need to add, that we distinguish between flat plane and modulated plane with some sinusoid. So another interesting question, because in images we don't have a flat situation, we already have some depth. And now the question is, we already have some depth difference, and we would like to know how much extra depth we need to add in order that we distinguish that these depths change, yes? So we have existing depth difference, and then we change depth, and we would like to, again, capture just noticeable difference. We would like to know when we will be able to spot this depth difference. So sensitivity to the depth changes will depend on two dimensions, yes? Spatial frequency and also existing already amplitude of corrugations. So essentially, if we would like to measure, and we did it because we could not find any dense enough data for us, we need to consider this dimensional space. So we need to choose some proper frequency samples and some amplitudes of disparity. We cannot go too far because then you have diplopia. You cannot fuse any more images. And then we measure in this space for each such point thresholds. So for medium frequencies will be the most sensitive threshold will be bigger. For higher frequency and lower frequency thresholds will increase. Then when we have higher amplitude, those thresholds are also higher. Yes, this is something what you expect. And we run this experiment by showing such sinusoid in this random dot stereogram, because the idea here is that we should eliminate other cues. Yes, so we don't want to use rendered images, because then there is shading, there are many other cues. We would like to isolate this just disparity cue. And the idea is that you use two alternative force choice, you show two images, and people should point out on the image where they see more depth. Yes, and this is kind of stepwise, so-called PEST procedure that will come, will converge to this just one GND difference, to the point when you start just seeing the difference in depth between those two corrugations. So then we get some function based on this data. We fit some function, and this function characterizes how we will see depth. Yes, but we would like to get some linear space, which for given disparity value will tell me what is response of human visual system. So we need to derive so-called transducer function. So what we are going to do, we will consider just one spatial frequency. So here is one spatial frequency, and there will be some changes across of amplitude, so the changes across disparity. And then, of course, along this line, we have different values of thresholds that make this signal that we can distinguish on this background corrugation. So this is just, I repeated the same graph, disparity and threshold for one spatial frequency of corrugations, yes? And now I would like to derive some response of human visual system on disparity, scaled in some linear perceptual space, yes? So essentially the idea here is that I have certain corrugation, certain amplitude, I check what amplitude I have, and I get threshold value for it, yes? Then I add again, so then I got this threshold value. So this means that having this amplitude, I can add this signal, and just in this point, we start perceiving differences. So another scenario, so essentially I derive information how much corrugation I need to add to see difference for given corrugation amplitude. And now I have another situation that I have significant difference in depth, and I would like to scale it in some units, which will be in some perceptually uniform scale. So essentially, I will do the following construct. Yes. So here is a certain amplitude, and for this amplitude, I will measure GND, this threshold. Yes. So now I am at this point. So now my amplitude is original amplitude plus this amplitude that came from one GND. So on this curve, I am already at this point. And then I measure threshold again, yes? So now I add this threshold here, yes? And now my total disparity would be beginning disparity plus those two disparities coming from two GNDs. And I continue this procedure up to the end. And in this particular case, it turned out that the spacing between those two depth patterns is just for GND. So essentially what I would like to get is I would like to derive what I call transducer, some function that will tell me, for given disparity, what would be human visual distance, system response, scaled in some perceptual linear scale. So now what would be nice is that if I have two depth differences, I can use transducer to make difference between those two depth differences, and they will be scaled in some unit in GNDs. So what we showed so far is that we know how human visual system responds to signal of different disparities and different frequencies. But we deal in the real world, of course, with complex images. So we have three distinct with disparity. This disparity is scaled in pixels. And what we would like to get, we would like to get a map of responses or map of perceived differences in depth. So what kind of problem we need to solve? Very briefly. Yes? So we need to come from pixel disparity to this angular disparity. That's so all my transducer is scaled in angular disparity. And another thing is I would need to find some association between sinusoidal pattern, because we know how human responds for different frequencies, and to go to complex images. So first thing is purely technical, but I would like to stress it just because depending what kind of literature you read, you will have the notion of disparity, which will mean different things. So in graphics or computer vision, disparity would be scaled in pixels. But in perception, disparity will be defined as the difference of these angles, vergence angles, while you observe two different points in the scene. So to express, to find the link between pixel disparity, you should do some simple math. You need to know what is interaxial distance between eyes. You need to know what is distance between screen. Then you could scale your input. You can express your input pixel disparity in vergence. This would be your first step in the computation. Yeah? So you take input image, scale it in vergence, do decomposition into frequency bands. So you use Laplacian filtering, first Gaussian, and then you subtract neighboring bands. You get Laplacian. Then you get band pass response, yes, of to input image. And then those differences between bands will, so here you need this difference between two vergence values, yes? So now we have those bands and they are scaled in as vergence. When you take difference between two bands, you get disparity, yes? So this is the way of going from pixel disparity to disparity, angular disparity. And so then we have those differences, and those differences are expressed already as disparity. And then we have our transducer function, and we can scale those differences in perceptual uniform scale. So the step of our algorithm will be as follows. We have pixel disparity in image space. We calculate vergence. Then we decompose image such scaled into different frequency bands. Yes? Then we take values of disparity in each frequency band, and we use transducer to derive corresponding response of human visual system in this perceptual uniform space. And then we have human perceptual response in perceptual uniform space. So now we can do subtraction, we can do mathematics, and the differences in depth will be scaled in some reasonable way. So now I can proceed with actually manipulating disparity. So I have some input disparity, I would like adjust it to compress it to fit to comfort zone that I mentioned at the beginning. And I would like to know what exactly I did. So whether I didn't lose some important depth information or I didn't introduce some distortion. So this is exactly what will happen. So we take original image. We have this vergence map. We run it over our machinery, decomposition into different bands and expressing in GND units, we take modified image, we do analogous processing, then we subtract per band differences, and then we have some differences per band that are scaled in GND units. And then we can collapse it using Minkowski summation to have one map. Yes? So now what people observe, and this was work of Lang at SIGGRAPH 2010, they observe that essentially all methods developed for tone mapping could be applied also for compression of disparity. Yes? This would be a very similar problem. This is why they will consider all kinds of functions that have been used for tone mapping. The problem is that they don't have control what really has been done. And using our machinery, essentially you can run, again, some small optimization problem that will be driven by our metric. And the task of, of this optimization would be minimize distortions, yes, or some other tasks don't introduce certain things, distortions over 5 GNDs or whatever. Yes. Just to the end, I would like to say about some other avenues that this machinery opened to us. So we measured those transducers for different types of stereo equipment. So anaglyph glasses, some shutter glasses, and autostereoscopic display with 8 zones of view. And it turned out to be slightly different. Also, this is well known that people have different sensitivity to depth. People are differently sensitive as they have different number of photoreceptors in the first place. Yes? So there are differences between us, some small differences. And some people cannot see depth at all. Some people can see it a little bit weaker. So the idea is that we can do personalization. Yes? So essentially, we have certain image and we would like that everybody see in terms of depth this image in the same way. This image has been seen by this person on this kind of device, and then in perceptual space we have such signal. Yes? So this is his response. Yes? And now what we can do, we can invert this model and take responses measured for this person. Yes? And then as effect we'll get kind of rescale disparity. So the outcome of such procedure should be that although those people different and see maybe content on different equipment, they should have similar depth impression. So I would say again, I mean, I'm talking here only about binocular disparity. Unfortunately, there are many more cues and this is not the end of the world. Yes, I mean, this is just one kind of insight and one should look how those even luminous contrast, how it interacts with disparity, things like that. There are many interactions. And the final thing that I would like to show is backward compatible stereo. So here the idea is, again, I come back to CornSuite, so I make a big loop. I show quite a lot of CornSuite, I spent quite some time. So now I will show one more application of this CornSuite, but in this time applied to depth signal. Yes? So when we have typical anaglyph image, when someone has anaglyph images, can see images for person without anaglyph glasses, of course, this image looks poorly, yes? What this is inverse situation, person without glasses can see this image, but of course there is no use of anaglyph image if this image doesn't contain this anaglyph signal. So what we would like to achieve is that whether you look in glasses or without glasses, you, in this case, have some impression of stereo, of 3D. In this case, you see possibly undistorted image. So how this can be achieved? So I come back again to CornSuite illusion, and when you take an effort, and some people did, they use piece of wood with this kind of exactly CornSuite profile. Yes, so you can imagine that you keep piece of wood, and this wood is profiled in depth according to such profile. Yes, and then what happens is that CornSuite effect will work. So essentially, you would see those two planes as shifted in depth. Yes. So since we have this effect also in disparity space, it would be very easy for us to use it in the same way as we use for enhancement of contrast in image space. Yes. So what actually we do is that we introduce, and this is image of disparity. So for traditional anaglyph images, you somehow accumulate. When you add more depth, you add more disparity. Yes, this is why those objects in front and in back, they will have relatively high disparity, close to zero near the image space, image plane. Yes, and in our approach, what we are going to do, we will add disparity only at depth discontinuities. So we will be essentially fluctuating near image plane. Yes, so this way, we introduce some disparity. If you look carefully, of course, there is disparity at edges. But it's relatively, you can see it, yes? But you cannot compare how invasive is this anaglyph signal in our approach and in this approach. And I didn't prepare this demonstration, but if someone would have glasses, we can see some images, or just please go and look on the web page for this paper. Please go to web page of Piotr Didyk. And then when you have anaglyph glasses, you will see that this really works quite well. So here are some other examples. In this cluttered image, still you can see anaglyph images. In our case, you could see, but they're well hidden. So there is some pattern like that. But impression of that would be very, very similar. I mean, our slightly compressed in our case, but still you will get impression of 3D. So I would like to wrap up briefly this talk. In this talk, I referred to apparent image qualities that are often not physically measurable, but still I hope that I convince you that by applying certain illusions that are kind of strong, I could get clearly visible and sustainable improvement of perceived various qualities of images. I discussed contrast, brightness, depth range, temporal and spatial resolution cases. So all those dimensions can be somehow improved. And just to the end, I would like to say that those days we witnessed a new kind of research field starts to be defined. Yes, it was around for some time. We could call it computational display. So we have computational photography, yes, when essentially we use some strange optics and then we use some computation, and then at the end of the day we get some quality improvement of or light field kind of information, things like that. Yes, you could go to the end of this pipeline and think about computational display. Yes, so here I show you some examples, yes, that we use, for example, temporal integration, and we display it kind of garbage, frame by frame, but kind of skillfully designed. And when it was integrated in the eye, then you got like useful signal. Yes, so we didn't modify really displays. Yes, but what people do right now, they modify also displays. Yes, they play with autostereoscopic displays, with these lens-led parallax barriers. And when they will also design specific content for those kind of tweak displays, they can achieve new effects. And what I discuss, I would say that this is some small branch of this larger, much wider computational display. I would dub it perceptual display. Yeah? So we take into account, again, knowledge in perception in order to improve quality of displayed images. And this work, of course, comes mostly from this group of collaborators and PhD students. So at this point, I would like to thank you for inviting me and for being so patient. But this was designed that way, so I think I used to delimit my time.